Welcome to the MMA Roadshow, episode number 120. My name is John Morgan. Cole Coffee is, well, he's in Brooklyn, New York right now. He is wrapping up after that, can we just say shit show? Good God. I am in Thackerville, Oklahoma. I am here for Bellator 181. Campos versus Gertz 3. That's right. I am at the Windstar World Casino and Resort here in my room. And I probably just finished doing exactly what a lot of you guys finished doing, and that is watching the abomination of oppressor that was Mayweather versus McGregor in Brooklyn, New York. And I got to say, I'm just disappointed, man. I am just disappointed. I've been following this thing along. As you guys know, we talked about it last week. I did not attend those. So there was just too much going on. We had some meetings in Las Vegas. Was originally going to go to Scotland, but didn't do that. We've got the European team taking the Glasgow card over here. So I ended up making the quick trip here. But didn't make the Mayweather McGregor press tour. Instead, we sent Cole Coffee out there. He's the videographer. He's the one that can get the quality footage, and that's what we really need. You know, you guys want to see the face-offs, and of course, you know, there's still plenty of coverage left to do for this fight, and we wanted the B-roll and that sort of thing. As you've seen, it's tough for reporters. If you've been following the coverage, if you're just a normal print reporter, there's really not a whole heck of a lot you can't do from home that you need to be there for. The struggles of logistics and how things were going to work. We kind of knew going in it was going to be tough. So, you know, save a few bucks. Would have been fun to soak up the environment, but we ended up sending Cole Coffee. And it's been a struggle for him. It's been a struggle. I'll tell you a really funny story once I get my thoughts out about this. About it. It became even more of a struggle for the man Cole Coffee. But I tell you what, this Brooklyn presser that just wrapped up, seriously, I just closed the stream and hopped on here and hit record. And I tell you what, it's still fresh in my mind and it's just disappointing. I mean, from start to finish, there was nothing good about it. I mean, hours late. I get it. Listen, Floyd Mayweather, notoriously late. Notoriously late for everything. Kevin Ioli has a story the other day where he was trying to go interview Floyd Mayweather, and I guess Floyd told him to be there at like 9 in the morning or something, and he showed up, and then it's no later. Finally, Kevin Ioli goes home and goes to sleep and gets a text at like 3 a.m. the next morning. Like, hey, I'm ready. Come on down. Like, dude, I'm sleeping, So notoriously late, and that's fine. But, I mean, you're trying to captivate the world right now. You know what I mean? You're trying to captivate the world. And people don't have all day. They don't have all day. And I get it. There's some showmanship to it. Conor wants to make Floyd wait. Floyd wants to make Conor wait. It's a big ego thing. Who's the bigger star? Who's the A side? That's what everybody's trying to prove. I get that to a degree, not hours. Now you're just inconveniencing people. Now you're alienating the fans that you're trying to get to buy the pay per view. Not to mention the people in Brooklyn who, it's kind of late in the evening there on a weeknight. They got work tomorrow and they wanted to come see the show, and instead they're, sitting around for hours, not sure. Should they run to the bathroom real quick? Should they buy a beer? I don't know. Maybe they're going to show up. Hell, I just saw a tweet that Esther Lynn, MMA Fighting's Esther Lynn, of course, she shoots for Showtime as well, that I guess she didn't even get to shoot the damn thing because she had to get on a plane to London. She doesn't get to fly private. She's flying commercials. She's got to go get on that plane. One of the most talented photographers in the game didn't even get to shoot the press conference because she's got to go get on a plane to go to the next one. How does that make any damn sense? So that's just the logistics of it, right? Now let's talk about the content itself. It's sad. Listen, L.A. was fun, right? The starts off, L.A. was fun. Connor got, I say Mayweather won that first day. Connor, didn't really know the format, he said. He walked out there and was like, I got to give a speech. He wasn't prepared to give a monologue. And I thought he got kind of handled a little bit. Then the microphones weren't working when he was trying to come back against Floyd Mayweather. Showtime says they had nothing to do with it. I believe him. Trust me, I believe them. This is one of those things where if you think that they have the wherewithal to make sure his microphone is cut off, you obviously don't see what else is happening, man. They can't pull off something like that. I mean, this thing is a mess. There's a reason Dana White said it's going to be a shit show. There's a reason he said it. Toronto was awesome. Toronto was like the peak, right? Connor made the adjustments. He was ready. He was prepared. He had some material going. And he was more engaged, and you know, I thought he had some great things. I mean, man, cutting low, and you go, why do you got the school bag, Floyd? We know you can't read. Tough, right? Cutting deep, you know? And everybody's wondering, hey, is he going to say something about the domestic violence record that Floyd Mayweather has? So, I mean, I thought Toronto was great. I watched. I was sitting in meetings. We had full USA Today sports meetings right now. Dan Stupp is in Las Vegas. Matt Erickson is in Las Vegas. The young Mike Bond came down to Las Vegas. The radio team was there. We were all in these meetings with all of USA Today Sports. Of course, I had to watch it, so I was paying attention to everything. I had it pulled up on my computer. I got my headphones in one ear, so I'm listening to the press conference. I'm listening to the meeting with the other ear, you know, multitasking. And it's funny because I got a text from a coworker, not an MMA Junkie coworker, but somebody else that's in another part of the company. And it comes up on my phone, and he's like, is that live? Because he could see that on my computer – I had the press conference pulled up, and I was like, yeah, it is. And he pulled it up on his phone. So, I mean, it was good theater, right? It was great. And then today, man, it just all came crashing down. You know, the reports that are there is that, you know, the in-arena experience was bad. But just for me watching, terrible, terrible, absolutely terrible. And the thing that really sucks about it to me is that, you know, the reason people love Conor McGregor is because he's a showman. And yeah, I mean, he's a great fighter. But that's not why he's transcended the way he has. It's because he's an incredible showman. And I love the idea of this tour. I love the visuals, man. When, you know, when you get that big stage, you know, the UFC does that sometimes where you come in and just the visuals of this massive stage and the lights and the artwork and the I mean, it feels big. And this stuff felt big, you know, but it just melted down today. It's too much of a good thing, I guess, in a row, you know? And the thing is, Conor, his cleverness is what makes him great. I mean, right? What's the quintessential Conor line, right? We're tired of hearing it by the mouth, but who the fuck is that guy, right? I mean, that's the quintessential Conor line. And what was that? I mean, that was off the cuff, quick, you know, turning around, addressing, you know, assessing the situation with Jeremy Stephens, and then just, you know, just cutting the man down to his knees, just sharp, quick rhetoric. You know what I mean? That was just awesome. And this is bad. I don't like the gangster stuff, man. I've addressed this before with Conor. And don't get me wrong. I mean, the man has worked himself from welfare to a $100 million check in 4 years. So far be it from me to question his decision-making and strategy. The dude has done well for himself, and he deserves kudos and credit for calling his shot everywhere along the way. So I'm not trying to sit here and act like me in Thackerville, Oklahoma right now have better advice for how he should handle himself. He's done well. But, man, you know, that Conor McGregor we got at the very first fight, you know, that 60 G's, baby, three people died making this pocket watch, you know, that stuff. I mean, I'm going to blow all my money on new suits and this. I mean, I don't know, man. That excitement was awesome. And even then, you know, it's not like you got to be all positive. You can be sharp. That sharp, quick wit, man, that's what I love. This just walking around and you're a bitch, you're a bitch, you're a hoe, you're a bitch. It's just not imaginative, creative, entertaining. It's not entertaining. Did anybody watch that press conference and say, I can't wait? I know I sure didn't. Hell, the only thing I thought was, man, maybe they should just call off London tomorrow. Maybe they should just call. Because you think it's going to get, I mean, I'm praying it gets better. I'm praying they got some people talking to him right now. Maybe they're coming up with some jokes. And I'm not trying to say you got to have the Chael Sonnen pre-written thing, but maybe some bullet points and some things you can address. You know, I mean, Conor brings up the fact that some people are calling him racist. I don't think he's a racist. I don't think he's a racist. But there's no question that, you know, some of the things he said could potentially have racist connotations. And I think that's all anybody was talking about was, hey, was this out of line? Is this okay? And then to respond the way he did, I'm half black from the waist down. I mean, come on, man. You're better than that. Conor McGregor, you are better than that. I'm going to tune in tomorrow, of course. I want to tune in to the London one if they don't cancel it. I mean, hell, it's late in London right now. As I'm sitting down right here, like I said, the press conference just ended Thursday night the way we do on the MMA Roadshow. It's already 2:30 in the morning in London. They still got to fly over. Now, granted, they're flying in private jets. They can probably lay out in a full bed. You know, they don't have to go through customs. They don't have to go through all that. So, I mean, it's not quite the journey that it is to do commercial, but it's still a little bit of a journey. You're still going to get a little bit of jet lag. You think they're going to have time to rewrite some material in between then or feeling fresh? I don't know. I tell you, the other thing that's weird, too, is that, I mean, at the end of the day, we just like the fights, right? I mean, we love the fights. Justin Gaethje, Michael Johnson, two warriors just going out there and literally pouring their hearts out, literally just doing everything possible, showing their courage, just, I mean, that's one of the greatest fights you'll ever see, right? So that's what, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I don't think we'll look back on Gaethje and Johnson and think this was such a great fight because of all the pre-fight hype, you know. No, that just adds to it. In a situation like this, of course you need pre-fight hype. But I tell you what's weird is that, you know, I guess we're supposed to have the edge and the concern, you know, that they're up there and you know, it could erupt at any moment because they hate each other so much, da-da-da-da. But it's weird that they just let them go up and have, like, face-offs and nobody's around them. Dana White's been the one, if you've been paying attention, Dana White at every one of these press conferences has been the one that's gone up there and stood in between them. Or been the one to be like, hey, that's long enough. Let's pull them apart now. It's been Dana. And he's not even supposed to be promoting this thing, right? This is Mayweather Promotions in association with McGregor Sports and Entertainment. And hell, Dana's the one out there going, you know, I don't know if this is such a great idea for us to just be like 15 feet away while these two dudes are staring at each other, jawing. I don't know. Today is the first day I've been disappointed. I mean, this fight, I've said it from day one, the spectacle of it is fun. It's fun. We may never see something like this again in our lifetime, especially if it keeps going like this. We ain't never going to see nothing like this again in our lifetime. But we may never get this opportunity to see something like this. So, yeah, it sucks. I mean, it puts the lightweight division on hold and whatever. But good for Conor, man. Good for him. And good for combat sports. And good, you know what I mean? Good for boxing. Good. The world's attention. That's all anybody wants to talk about. That's all anybody wants to talk about. And today's the first day I've been disappointed. I still feel like Floyd Mayweather wins this fight, right? I still do. I'm still picking Floyd Mayweather decision. Gun to the head, Floyd Mayweather by decision. One of our USA Today co-workers, Jason Ford, he said it last night perfect. We were having a couple frosty beverages after the meetings, and he was like, look, if you got $50, you put it on Conor McGregor. If you got $50,000 that you have to bet, you know, $50,000 of your own money, you put it on Floyd Mayweather, right? I mean, that's the truth. Conor does have a chance. No matter what anybody says, Conor does have a chance. And he does look in incredible shape. Since he wasn't wearing a shirt today, we got to see that he does look in incredible shape. He's a special athlete, man. He really is a special athlete. That day that John Kavanaugh came and introduced himself to me in Stockholm before Conor's first fight, I mean, that was the words he used. This kid's special. And he's right. He is special. The mental fortitude, the confidence, everything that everybody talks about, it's all true. And I've said that for years. The thing that I love about Conor is everything he says he believes. He believes in his heart. He's a Celtic warrior reincarnated from the battlegrounds. You know what I mean? He believes that. And everything that he's said along the way, he's made happen. So, you know, as Dana White said, you can't doubt him. How do you doubt him? You can't. You can't doubt him. So he's got a chance, but Floyd Mayweather's the pick, right? I mean, Floyd Mayweather by decision. That's the pick. I'm not feeling these people that are saying, you know, Floyd's going to knock him out in round four or whatever. I'm not feeling that. But I think, you know, Floyd outpoints him. But all that said, I want to be there. I want to see that fight. You know, hell, I mean, if I'm not there, if I don't get credentialed, because I don't know. We don't know how credentialing is going to be handled. They're certainly not going to be able to credential as many people for the fight as they have for the press conferences, you know. So who knows what's going to happen. But even if I'm not there, even if for whatever reason, now this will not happen, but if Dan Stubbs schedules me off that night and says, John, you're off, I'm still going to buy the pay-per-view, right? Even if I'm chilling by myself at home, not having to work, not having to write anything, no, I'm buying that pay-per-view. Of course I am. Who's not? Got to see the show. Got to see the spectacle. But today's the first day. I'm not excited about it. And I tell you what, when I finish this podcast, I'm going to go downstairs, and I guarantee you, because this is a small Bellator show, I'm staying right here at the host hotel, well, basically because I don't think there's much else around. But I guarantee you, everybody's going to kind of have that same look on their face. All the fight people here, the fighters, the camps, the Bellator staff. I mean, everybody that's involved in the sport. It's not like Bellator staff members don't watch the UFC, or hell, that UFC staff members don't watch Bellator. You know, anybody that's in the fight game was watching this today. And I guarantee you, everybody's going to have that same look on their face like, I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know. London, you know, will be a few hours away by the time Cold Coffee is able to edit this together, put out the podcast. London won't be too far away. Hopefully we get a better go of it in London. Maybe they can change the format a little bit. Maybe give the USC style press conference a try for the last one. I mean, it went off the rails today. I don't know. I hope Connor can rebound. I hope we can see the clever side of him, man. The quick wit, not just you're a bitch, you're a hoe, you're a bitch, you're a hoe. I've got a big penis. Hopefully we see something a little more. All right, so let me tell you a story about Cold Coffee, right? This is great. Now, if you listened last week, we talked about his schedule. It was a crazy schedule. And luckily, we found a pretty affordable flights. We had to get him from Vegas to L.A. Then he had to fly from L.A. to Toronto. Then he had to fly from Toronto to Brooklyn. And then he had to get home from Brooklyn on Friday morning because it's his girlfriend's birthday. And today, actually, Agent H. So he misses being home on her birthday, but they had a camping trip planned for Friday and Saturday, so they're going to go do that. So he wanted to make sure he got home as early as possible on Friday morning. And, of course, you know, budget was a concern. It would be easy if we could just say, yep, we'll pick that flight because it's the perfect direct flight, and we'll pick that flight because but we can't do that. We got to save money. As many events as we go to, I think that's one thing people don't realize sometimes is, you know, we budget shop the best we can, man. We find the cheapest flights. We take connections sometimes when maybe there's direct flights available, but the connection is cheaper. You know, we stay at hotels that aren't the host hotel when the host hotel is just too expensive. You know, we try to find a way to make it work. So we did that. So, you know, it's kind of a tight schedule. It's going to be a brutal one. As we said, you know, Cold Coffee wasn't even going to have a hotel for a couple of the nights. He's basically just going to sleep on the plane. So we're getting started, and he hits me up in L.A. He's standing in line and to get into the venue. And Simon Simano, our new editor, is with him. And I don't know what prompted Simon to ask him, but Simon basically said, you got your passport, right? Because you're going to Toronto tomorrow. And Cold Coffee says, oh, shit. I do not have my passport with me. I do not have my passport with me. So he calls me up, and I'm at home. This is in the afternoon still, before the press conference, before the Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. He's like, John, I do not know what to do. He's like, I am so sorry. I don't have my passport. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. What am I going to do? And he's freaking out. And I'm like, bro, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. You got a lot to do. You're there by yourself. You've got to get this footage, which is very important. You know, obviously, as you can imagine, our traffic has been great this week on MMA Junkie. So we need to have these videos. We need to have everything that we can. Don't worry about it. I'll figure it out. And so I called American Airlines, and I started looking online, and I was hoping they wouldn't charge us a change fee because, I mean, like, he can't get on the plane anyway. He doesn't have a passport, so why charge me a change fee if I change the reservation? So that was my hopes because American Airlines, I always buy the non-refundable tickets because we rarely have issues. And when we do, you have to pay $200. So it is technically refundable. I mean, you can just apply it to another travel. So what we figured out was there was a way for Cold Coffee to fly from like 9:30 p.m. on Tuesday night back to Vegas at 10:55. His girlfriend brought his passport to the airport, met him there, and then from that 10:55, he had to pick up his baggage and all that. And then he had to jump back on a 1:20 a.m. flight out of Vegas to Dallas, and then from Dallas straight to Toronto. So he was supposed to go from L.A. to Philadelphia. That changed. So we had to cancel one flight, add one flight, and reroute. I mean, there was some scrambling to be done. And you're doing this all last minute. I mean, we're talking about 5 or 6 hours before the plane's about to take off. And thank God. I mean, because Cole Coffey's like, dude, if I got to pay for this out of my pocket, I'll do it. I am so sorry. I'm like, well, bro, of course we're not going to do that to you. I mean, the company's got to pay for it. But, you know, we're having company meetings, and they're all about budgets and execution and that sort of thing. So the last thing we do is spend a lot of money. And thank God. Somehow the flights were cheaper. I guess it was so last minute. It was so last minute that the rates had dropped. So even though there was a $200 change fee, the rates were cheaper, even though we added another flight, and we ended up only paying $109 total to get everything switched for him. So it added one more flight for him. It certainly added to his stress level. And then, oh, my God. You know, I wanted to have Cole Coffey on tonight. You know, I wanted to hook him up and talk about this, but everything ran so damn long. So, see, the Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor screwing up the MMA roadshow, too. So out of all the things they did wrong, that's the worst. They screwed up the roadshow plans. So we'll have Cole Coffey weigh in next week for sure. I talked to maybe about Frank Mir and Richard Hunter, about maybe getting with those guys, the boys at Phone Booth Fighting. Might be a good week with Frank getting his release. Maybe we could do a swap cast like they like to do. Something like that next week. I don't know. We'll see. But we'll definitely get him to tell some stories. It was insane. I'm sure you guys have seen the coverage. I mean, there's scrums before the press conference or before the monologues, or whatever you want to call it. There's scrums afterwards. Dana's here. Leonard Ellaby's there. Floyd's there. Connor's there. It has been absolutely almost impossible to keep track of everything. So, Cole Coffey, man, shout out. If you want to hit him up on Twitter, at Ken S. Hathaway, let him know you appreciate it, because he has been run over, man. I feel bad because he's going to get home tomorrow morning and is supposed to be celebrating with his girl. And I imagine he's going to be pretty damn exhausted, and just ask her if he could maybe get some sleep, rest up a little bit. All right, enough about that. We'll talk more about his experience behind the scenes. We'll watch the London press conference. We'll talk more about that next week. Hopefully, fingers crossed, finish this thing well. Man, if this thing is a shit show, if London is as bad as Brooklyn, and that's the last we see these guys for a couple weeks, I mean, you know, they're going to be doing behind-the-scenes stuff, and maybe that'll get us recharged and re-energized, but yeesh. Yeesh. All right, listen, so we talked about Tuesday, Dana White's Contender Series. That was something I got to do, you know, after a busy week, kind of recharged a little bit on Monday. And I worked Monday night, Sunday. I had Sunday off, kind of spent a little time with the family. Then Monday I had to work. And then Tuesday, I was really excited about this. Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. I liked it. If you didn't check it out, do. I think you should. I have not gone back and watched. I wanted to, but I've been so busy since then with all this Mayweather stuff and the meetings. I did not watch the Snoop cast. I did not. We did. I will say this. We could smell the weed. And this was great because they talked about the best line of the night came from a USC employee who shall remain nameless, but said, hey, well, when we envisioned this concept, we said we wanted it to be like smokers in a gym. Get it? Smokers? Yeah, you could smell the weed smoke. It was pretty funny. So if you guys thought that, because I did see some people tweeting out, they were checking out the Snoop cast, that the Snoop basically was like, hey, are we allowed to fire it up? And I guess they got the green light. Yeah, no pun intended there, green light. To fire up the green, and it was funny because we could smell it in there. So he was not sitting cage side. I think they were in, if I was guessing, I think they were in, there's a little control room at the top of the Tough Gym where the producers oversee things there. And I think that's probably where they were. At the very least, they were in another room separated. But the weed permeated the building. So that was pretty funny. But it's a cool thing. You know, with all the media, they're only going to allow 10 media per week is my understanding. So 10 media, we'll see if they even get that many applications. I mean, you know, there's no reason to travel for it if you're not in Las Vegas. There's not many more of us than 10 total that live there, you know. So I don't think they'll ever be full. But it ended up being just three of us. Since all the media went to Anaheim for the press conference, or to Los Angeles, I should say, for the press conference. And it was just me, Mike Bond and Case Kiefer. But it was cool, man. Being in that gym, first of all, it's tight. It's really tight quarters. It's hot because, you know, you got those bright lights, those production quality lights, but in a really small room. So it's super hot in there. And it's funny because it actually rained that day, one of the few days a year it actually rained. So it was like a humidity in the air as well. So it's really hot in there. They did allow friends and family, which is cool because it adds a little bit of environment. The other thing is it's kind of tense, all right? Because, you know, if you're in a big arena and you got, you know, one guy's mom and dad and girlfriend yelling for him and the other guy's mom and dad and girlfriend yelling for him, but they're on opposite sides of the cage, it's no big deal. There's just two sets of bleachers. It's set up just like Tough, right? Two sets of bleachers. So, I mean, you're talking about being 5 or 6 feet apart, you know, screaming at the top of the lungs. Some people are more vocal than others, but, you know, kick his ass! Kick his ass! Knock him out! You're 5 feet away going, you know, that's my boyfriend. That's my son. Shut the up. So that makes for some tension there. But good fights overall. If you didn't check them out, it was fun. They ended up giving away two contracts that night. Kurt Holobolik, actually fantastic in the main event. They said they're not really calling it main event because it's not really a main event. But the final fight of the night, he looked really good right from the start. Kurt Holobaugh has been in the UFC before. It's kind of funny because I talked to looking through his record. I remember I was like, didn't he only fight once? I actually talked to Sean Sheldon. Like, how the hell did he only fight once in the UFC? But I had forgotten that was when the Strikeforce and was kind of merging. So he fought once in Strikeforce under Zuffa and once in the UFC under Zuffa. So he fought twice for the company, lost both fights, and they let him go. And I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of thought he got wronged. But anyway, made his way back in because you rarely see guys get one chance in the UFC. So he kind of got two. It was just one for Strikeforce, one for the UFC. Now he's back. We didn't get to talk to him afterwards. He did suffer a broken hand. So even though he did get a contract, it's going to be a while because he's got to let the hand heal up. But he looked fantastic in knocking out Matt Bissett. So just, I mean, was on point from the very beginning. The other guy that won was Boston Salmon. He was granted a UFC contract as well. And Boston Salmon is, if you haven't seen him fight, I like this kid a lot. His striking is unbelievable. Powerful, quick, just phenomenal, right? And if you remember, when we were talking to Robert Follis, so you said, hey, man, here's a kid to keep your eye on. I had actually seen him fighting Tough Enough. I had called, I know, at least one of his fights, maybe I think two, to be honest with you. And I'd seen him, but I know I'd seen him. So if the other one I didn't call, I was at least at it. And just very impressed with his hand speed, with his striking, with the power, with the way he delivers. He fought for the RFA as well. Had a split decision loss that was a hotly contested split decision loss. That's the only reason he's got one loss. Otherwise, he'd be undefeated in his career. And I think this kid has got something. So was happy to see that he was one of the guys that made it. That's one of the greatest things I love about this job. You know, covering guys like, you know, Conor McGregor and you know, George St. Pierre and Anderson Silva and, you know, Ronda Rousey. Like, covering them as their superstars is great. But what I love more than anything is seeing people rise up, you know, to follow their whole journey. It's one of the reasons I'm into the prelim fights. I love smaller shows. I dig it. I love seeing that next wave of talent, you know, because you never know. You know, Alan Jouban was a guy that fought at Tough Enough, and then I ended up calling his first two professional fights, I think. I know at least his first one at Tachi Palace Fights, you know, so really got to see him early on and then watch him come to the UFC. There's nothing I love more than that, just watching people develop. And so to see Boston Salmon be on this very first week of Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series and get a contract. Pretty cool. I was happy I got to be there cage side. I'm planning on being there pretty much every week as long as I can. If I'm in town, I plan on being there. We're just doing brief little recaps. We're not going to do in-depth. We're not covering the weigh-ins. You know, the weigh-ins are, I mean, if you want to, I think they're open to the public. They're at the Palms, I think, every Monday morning at like 9 a.m. But I mean, they're not even setting up backdrops or, you know, it's I mean, listen, these are not UFC fighters. These are not UFC fights. The company got a, you know, Dana White got his own promoter's license basically as this new entity. So it's Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. They make five and five is what they make. Everybody on our card signs a one fight deal. Five to show, five to win, 5,000 that is. So you can make 10 grand if you win the fight, 5 grand if you lose, which is not bad. Not bad. It's more than I think a lot of people are getting on the regional stage. So, but I dug it. I really enjoyed it, and I thought some of those performances were really good. You know, Dana said, and I think he's right, that, I mean, he's expecting some great fights because people know potentially one fight away from being in the UFC. And think about this. Boston Salmon was coming off a loss. Controversial loss, but it was a loss. And yet he gets this appearance. He gets this opportunity. He makes it in. You don't have to go through the whole tough thing. It's a different way of doing it. So, I don't know. I thought it was cool. I love the concept of Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. I love live fights on Fight Pass. That's what they need. And they have more control over this a little bit, you know, than some of these other regional promotions that are turning in whatever. So, love this concept. And it was fun. If you didn't check it out, do it. I think the fights were good. And hopefully we continue to get good fights. So, with that in mind, got a short little interview with Boston Salmon. This was him directly after winning his UFC contract, and we got a chance to speak with him. Again, a kid that I do agree. I think you should keep your eye on. I think he's got a lot of talent.
Well, Boston, let's just talk about the experience first. I mean, coming here, you've been working towards, you know, getting this opportunity for a long time. Getting here in the tough gym, being under the lights, Dana White, cage side. What was the feeling like at the start of the fight?
Honestly, it was I can't really explain how this experience felt. You know, I felt like it was a ordinary Tuesday at Extreme Couture, just sparring. You know, I didn't get that adrenaline rush. I didn't have those nerves that ran through me. You know, and it was definitely a different feeling. It almost felt like it was a practice and not a fight.
So. Did that concern you at all? I mean, I hear some fighters say when they're not nervous, that's when they're worried because they feel like they should be nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really concerned. I looked at it as another opportunity for me to actually showcase and showcase my talent, my skills. You know, I looked at it, you know, I could look at it as practice, but at the end of the day, it was a fight, and I was here to win, be victorious.
How do you feel about your performance? I mean, obviously your shots were landing. It looked like you might even be able to finish him in the first round, but he was durable as hell. How do you feel the whole thing played out?
Yeah, Ricky was a tough kid, you know, 8-0. He was kind of like a booger, you know. I know I had to put him away. And obviously that didn't happen, you know. He was a tough kid. Took a lot of my shots. We game planned really good for this fight. And I thought I would have got the finish, but sometimes it doesn't work that way. So we train for 3 to 5 rounds, you know. So if it goes to that distance, then we're going to finish it in a good result.
A lot of people in the crowd yelling, don't let it go to the judges. You know, you have a bad history there. So, you know, when it went to the judges, was that little piece in the back of your head worried at all?
Man, nowadays you never know, you know. There's always bad decisions in if it goes with boxing and mixed martial arts, you know. I never prepared for a loss, you know, and my last fight was a loss, and I felt, you know, 100% confident that I won that whole fight, you know, but the result obviously didn't go my way. And you never know what to expect after the fight with the judges and with the results. So you always kinda want to finish your opponent, but that never happens all the time, you know.
You're a UFC fighter now.
Yes, sir.
How does that feel?
It feels amazing, man. We've been doing this, you know, since I was a kid. This has always been a dream. I knew one day this would happen, you know. Obviously, we took another route. We went to a contender show. I know I'm going to be a champion one day. And I'm thankful. I'm blessed. And it's a pleasure to showcase my skills in front of this amazing organization.
We didn't get to see the broadcast or anything, so tell us what happened after the fight. Did Dana talk to you directly, or how did you get the news that you were getting a contract?
We were just sitting in the kitchen. They walked us out, and they called my name. They told me congratulations. Never met Dana White in person before. I worked valet at the Palms, and he'd come in, and, you know, he would take care of us, but never spoke a word with him, you know, so this was actually the first time I got to see him, you know, one-on-one, and just that feeling of joy where, you know, I get to shake the big boss's hand and getting presented that contract to be in the UFC, to focus on my dreams, to be world champion one day was amazing. It's an experience that I can't even talk about, man. And I'm excited.
What's the biggest tip you gave him?
Dana White, man, he's a good guy, you know. No matter what, if he comes in valet or not, he's always 100 bucks in, 100 bucks out. No matter what, no excuses. He's always taking care of his the industry, man. And me and my staff at Encore Beach Club, Palms Valet, we're very thankful of anytime Dana White comes in.
What was that like for you, specifically the first time he pulls up the valet? Did you try to talk to him and be like, hey, I got this fighting career? What was that like for you?
My first thought was, I must have been 3-0 back then, you know. I had a little reputation for me, you know. I felt like I was a prospect, but I wasn't the one to, you know, go up to Dana White and be like, hey, you know, my name is Boston Salmon, and I'm a UFC fighter. I'm not like that, you know. I want to showcase my skills and prove that I belong in the UFC, you know. So we had other guys taking care of Dana White, and I knew the opportunity one day was going to present itself, so I'm thankful and I'm happy to be here.
You said tonight felt just like training, but what about training, getting ready for this? Does that feel any different knowing you had such a big opportunity in this fight?
No, not really, you know. The only problem that I have is I work two jobs, you know. A lot of fighters get that opportunity of just training full-time, you know. So if I, with this contract, you know, I could be a full-time fighter now. I don't have to worry about, you know, working two different jobs to maintain my financial bills and, you know, all that. So I'm very happy and blessed to make this a full-time job and make this a career, you know. It only gets better from here. I can grow and I can get better as a mixed martial artist, and I can just be good in every aspect of this game.
I know it's kind of, since you're from here, it's obvious why, but you had the most fans, friends and family here tonight. I mean, I know you said it was like any other fight, but what was that like kind of in an intimate environment, have so many people?
I honestly didn't expect that. You know, I'm from Waianae, Hawaii. I've been on here since right after high school, you know, and I feel like I built a pretty good fan base, you know, in Las Vegas and in Hawaii, and just being able to perform in national television, you know, I gained a pretty good fan base. So to go out there and, you know, have everyone support me and cheer for me at a smaller crowd, a smaller venue, it means a lot, you know. I carry that pride with me, and I'm very thankful.
Obviously, there's a lot of buzz around, you know, the Contender Series. I mean, it's something new, it's something exciting, something fight fans are really kind of rallying around. What's it like to be a part of something like this and the opportunity that it's going to give so many young fighters trying to break into the UFC?
This opportunity means a lot, you know. You got all these prospects fighting for this this Contender Show, you know, Contender Series. And I'm very thankful that I was one of the first to actually be live on that series, you know. And this pretty much gives an outlet for all these other prospects looking to become, you know, UFC champion to get that contract with the UFC. So I believe based off of, you know, not only my performance, but all the other fighters, the other four fighters with that performance, I feel like that's going to carry a huge following to follow the UFC Contender Show or Dana White's Contender Show, follow that on UFC Fight Pass and be a bigger stage for the UFC.
Welcome back to the Mayro Show. That was Boston Salmon, new USC fighter Boston Salmon. Again, we didn't get to speak to Kurt Holobaugh because Kurt was taken immediately to the hospital to go address the broken hand that he got in that first round knockout win, but he'll be in the USC as well. Hey, listen, even though it's just me rolling solo, and I know it's a way better show when I got cold coffee here so we can interact a little bit, but if you do like what you're hearing, do me a favor. Go into iTunes, log in, just, you know, rate us, review us, subscribe, do all the good stuff. Every little button you can hit helps us out. You can even leave us some feedback. If you leave us some feedback, I love it. You can even criticize a little bit. You can do like P Black did. Says that 5 stars. Now, it did say 5 stars, but P Black says there are only a few MMA podcasts I never miss, and this is one of them. I managed to set aside my concerns about the team's alcohol consumption, along with other things, to enjoy good, consistent, and passionate fight coverage. Even though you joke it's only your mother's listening, you have a dedicated listener with me in Seattle, longtime listener, first-time reviewer, Paige. So thank you, Paige, very much. I appreciate it. And, yeah, I think, you know, you're not the only one with concerns sometimes. Our mothers do listen. They do have concerns as well. So thank you. That means a lot. That feedback means all the world to me. So if you guys ever have a chance to do that, you're so inclined, trust me, I read them and I appreciate it. I'm down for your criticism too. Whatever we can do to get better. We're not pros at this. We're just having a little fun doing it. All right. What else can we talk about? Let's talk about being in the Tough Gym. It was funny because I had heard that The Ultimate Fighter was going to start filming on Wednesday, which is crazy. If you thought Cold Coffee had a crazy schedule, Dana White had a crazy schedule, but Dana White has a private jet too. So, but the Ultimate Fighter did get started filming on Wednesday morning. Justin Gaethje and Eddie Alvarez are the coaches. That was confirmed today to Luke Thomas while he was out there at the Brooklyn presser. I had heard that Justin Gaethje was in. We'd heard a lot about Kevin Lee potentially being in. I was actually told that Justin Gaethje's camp didn't really like the matchup, which I guess I kind of understand. Justin Gaethje, higher ranked, definitely got the buzz going right now. Eddie Alvarez, you know, a former champion. You know, so as far as the fight goes, I see why Justin Gaethje wanted that fight, like beating Kevin Lee, who's still kind of breaking in. I mean, you could argue that Kevin Lee is more deserving of a bigger fight than Justin Gaethje just because of the UFC record. You could make that argument. I think, you know, people that know the sport and the hardcores, I think they you know, they knew who Justin Gaethje was. They respect what he accomplished in World Series of Fighting. And, you know, I think for that reason, it does make sense. And, of course, again, just can't praise that fight enough, man. That's going to be one of my favorites forever. That'll be on my list forever. But I will say this. I was kind of disappointed because I kind of wanted to see a camera on Kevin Lee's face for 6 weeks. I love that guy, man. I love his wit. I love his trash talk. You know, he's a little bit over the top sometimes too. He's, you know, he presses a little too far every now and then. Sometimes I'm like, maybe you could dial it back a little bit. But I love it. I really do. And I was kind of hoping that him on Tough would be good. I think it would be better TV. I think this is going to be a good season. Wade, the introduction of the women's flyweight division, love it, love it, love it, love it. There was just no reason to have that gap in between the weight classes. There just wasn't, you know. So I'm glad this is done. I think it makes all the sense in the world. And I think any time you introduce a weight class like that, we haven't seen the cast list yet. I haven't even heard. I know it's kind of weird, but I try to avoid Tough spoilers just because. I know there haven't been any fights yet, but I don't know. I just try to avoid Tough spoilers, so at least like, when I watch the show, as I'm required to for work, it'll be interesting to me. But I'm excited for it. I kind of would have liked Kevin Lee, but I love it. Justin Gaethje, get him in there, get him in front of more eyeballs, because that guy is must watch TV. And Eddie Alvarez, man, I was just doing an interview earlier talking about, you know, the great shot at redemption for Eddie Alvarez. So that'll be good. But yeah, Dana did the LA press conference, flew in. He missed the first fight. Dana White missed the first fight of Dana White's contender series, the very first fight. So a little footnote in history. UFC president Dana White did not see firsthand the first fight in Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series, but he made it for the fights 2 through 5. Then he had to do film the first episode, which I imagine was more, you know, just a quick introduction, and he can run through that quick. He's got that down to a science. Then he had to haul ass up to Toronto again, the private jet, don't have the security, that sort of thing. You just pull your car right up. Pretty cool stuff. He made it. Speaking of, I'll tell you more about private jets here in a second. I did want to say too, you guys saw that Toronto stop. Daniel was wearing a Zuffa boxing t-shirt. Remember that. I wrote a story. Hopefully you saw it. Are they going to promote boxing? I'm going to say it right now. I can't write certain things that I can say on my own damn podcast. They're going to promote boxing. I'm just, you know, we'd already kind of heard about it before. And think about it. Remember that Dana White interview? Remember that 30-minute Dana White interview that we had a couple weeks back? Remember that pause? And I put a little clip in the video. Hopefully, if you don't remember the comment, go back in that story and I actually isolate it. Dana is telling me, you know, well, hey, we're doing great. We're doing big things. We're going to take, and he pauses, thinks about it, and says, combat sports to the next level. Not MMA, not UFC, not this sport, combat sports. It was no accident. You can tell as he's saying it. You can tell. It's measured. I reached out to comment. I didn't hear back from Dana White for comment. You know, maybe he's just busy. Obviously, he's got the press conferences and stuff going on. But I don't know. A lot of times when I don't hear back from him, it's because he doesn't want to tell me an answer. So we'll see how that looks. I mean, it makes sense, right? Put the UFC on Fight Pass. I mean, or put the UFC on Fight Pass. Jesus Christ. Put boxing on Fight Pass. I mean, they've already got kickboxing. They've already got jiu-jitsu. Why wouldn't you have boxing too? And, I mean, we're seeing by this nonsense the type of organization and structure and the way that the UFC goes about promoting. Man, they could boxing could use something like that. So I don't know. I'm excited. It's weird. What do you do? You got to get new matchmakers, right? I mean, do you expect Mick Maynard and Sean Shelby and Dana White between the three of them to know enough about all the boxers out there too? I mean, certainly they understand the sport, but are they keeping up with the talent that high, or do you have to bring in a whole new staff? What do you do? I don't know. Details thin, but there is no way that Dana showed up on accident wearing a Zuffa boxing shirt. It's just not an accident. Maybe, circumstantial evidence, the quote being what it was, the t-shirt being what it was, but him not answering my text. I don't know. I think they're going to do it. All right, I should say, by the way, all this talk about the UFC, all this talk about what had happened, I am here in Thackerville, Oklahoma, for my first time in Thackerville, Oklahoma. Just so you know, Thackerville is basically as soon as you cross the border into Oklahoma from Dallas, it is huge. This place is massive. Massive. They've got some advertising down there. It's the world's biggest casino, but that can't be right. There's got to be some asterisk next to that I'm not seeing. It can't be the world's, but it's pretty damn big. I'm not going to lie. Here for Bellator 181. This is not one of their tentpole events, but to be honest with you, our bosses at USA Today, they were pretty excited by the pay-per-view, what happened in New York, and they were like, hey, why don't we start covering a few more of these? And they asked me, you know, especially with the meetings that we had going on, they were like, hey, we'd prefer you not go to Scotland, you know, can you trust the European team over there to handle that event themselves? I said, of course we can, man. We got our man Abby over there holding it down. Pear's going to be over there, Sandu's with them. So, I mean, we got a crew over there. They're going to do fine. So, yeah, we could trust him. He's like, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you come to the meetings and why don't you go to Bellator and just feel it out and kind of see what opportunities are there. And so so we're here. We're committed to covering this one. We're committed to covering Bellator 182 as well, which is, again, not a tentpole event. Matt Erickson's going to be going out to that one. It's like an hour outside of Albany. So he's going to be there for that. It's a cool feel. Like I said, I actually got in early this morning. I took a red eye in overnight and then drove. It's about an hour and 5 minutes away from DFW Airport. So it's, you know, got to rent a car and drive up here. And, man, I got here at like 8 o'clock in the morning. Only sleep I'd had was, you know, the 2 hours and 20 minutes or so it takes to get here from Vegas. I was pretty tired. I thought I'd be able to check into my room. You know, wasn't too worried about the official weigh-ins. They did do the official weigh-ins here, but with all that's going on with Mayweather McGregor, I wasn't too worried about, you know, shooting a gallery or putting a video together, you know, with this not being a tentpole event, you know, with everything else that's going on. So, you know, my plan was just get in, get some sleep, and then be ready for the ceremonial weigh-ins, and then, of course, we'll get ready for the fights tomorrow. Well, I go to check in, and like, sir, we have no rooms available. Like, what? I mean, there's literally thousands of rooms here. You're telling me you don't have any rooms at all? No, sir. No rooms. Like, oh, fuck. Well, so I kind of just sat down in the lobby, and this is a move. You can try this move. If you ever run into a situation like this, here's the move. I just sat down in the lobby and went to sleep. I can sleep anywhere. You know, especially on 2.5 hours. I was tired. I can sit down and sleep anywhere. Traveling the world has made it so that I am constantly exhausted and I can sleep anywhere. So I just sat down in the lobby, fell asleep. Lady comes up and taps me on the shoulder. She's like, sir, you can't sleep here. And I'm like, well, I have nowhere else to go. She's like, well, I'm sorry, you can't sleep here. I was like, all right. Mike Kogan happened to walk up at that time, started talking to Mike a little bit about some things, and then I was like, well, all right. At that point, it was about 8:30 or so. So I'll go over and just, you know, go over and watch the official weigh-ins and, you know, kill some time. So I did that. Official weigh-ins all went good. No problem there. The main event is a catchweight. It's two lightweights. Derek Campos, Brandon Gertz, who are completing a trilogy between them, but it was actually a catchweight. The fight was made on kind of late notice, and so they agreed to a catchweight coming into it. Kendall Grove, John Salter, and the co-main event. Good to see Kendall Grove, man. I saw him earlier today. Walked up, said hello, talked to him for a little bit, man. That's a good dude, man. He's been around the game for a long time. A couple of prospects on the card. Excuse me, some of the prelims worth watching. So, you know me. We just talked about it. I like watching up-and-coming talent. So, we'll see how it goes. But, so we get done with the official weigh-ins, and now at this point, it's like 11:30. Talk to the PR crew here, CJ Tuttle, Ryan Grab. Talk, you know, just kind of shooting the breeze with them a little bit about what they got going on and kind of what the next few months look like for Bellator and just catching up with those guys. And I was like, all right, guys, I'm gonna go try and get my room again. So I go back. It's 11:30 now. Check in here is like 4. So I was like, I gotta try. So try to check in, sir. There's still no rooms available. If you want to try and come back at like 1, but check in's at 4. I'm like, God damn, I just want to go to sleep. So I tried the move again, only this time I made sure it was a couch that was just right in front of the desk. Just sat down right there, fell asleep, and I was asleep in minutes, moments, fell asleep. Once again, Lady comes up, taps me, she's like, sir, you can't sleep here. I'm like, well, I've got nowhere else to go. And at that point, one of the desk agents, she was like, she kind of gives me a look from across the way a little bit, and she kind of gives me the wave, like, come on. So I ran over there, and she was being kind of sneaky about it, but she finally got me a room. Big thank you to her. But yeah, if they ever tell you there's not a room available, just sit down and go to sleep, like right in their lobby. Just let them. That's probably a little bit of a Pam move, right? That's a little bit of a passive aggressive Morgan move right there. But it did get me in my room, and so I appreciate that. Took a little nap, went and watched the ceremonial weigh-ins, then watched the shit show that was Mayweather and McGregor. Yeah, And now we're here. All right, listen, I told you I'd tell you one more thing about private jets. Here's what it relates to. I had a chance earlier this week, after this weekend, before we came down here, to sit down with Dave Schaller. You guys remember Dave Schaller. You still see him out there, right? Former VP of PR for the UFC. He's now working for the Philadelphia 76ers, fulfilling a childhood fantasy of his to work for his hometown team, the team that he grew up rooting for. He actually grew up in Jersey, just up the road from Philadelphia, and that was kind of their local team. And now he's working for them. And he was back in Vegas for the Summer League, where the NBA teams have kind of their developmental guys. And so I said, hey, man, when you're in town, let's get together and catch up. I want to do what I really wanted to do was, while he was in town, was to get him to talk about the John Jones, Daniel Cormier brawl, right? I mean, he was right there in the middle of it. It's one of the most famous moments in UFC history, right, in recent times. And I don't, you know, he couldn't talk about it at the time, really. I mean, yeah, off-record conversations or whatever, but he couldn't really talk about it. So I thought, man, what a fun opportunity that would be with the rematch coming up in a couple of weeks to have him talk about that. And then while I had him, we ended up talking about quite a few things as well. We're going to end up making videos out of these, so I'm gonna break them all up and, you know, have them have different videos basically of everything that happens along the way. But I thought, I mean, shouldn't the Roadshow listeners get first dibs, right, to hear the whole conversation? And the reason where the private jets come up is that he's like, yeah, tell you what, come meet me at my hotel. I'm like, yeah, for sure, we'll come by your hotel. Me and Cole Coffee will do that. Where are you at? Oh, I'm at the Mandarin. Like I've ever set foot inside the Mandarin, right? Dude, so nice. This place is so nice. And it was funny because I was, you know how you kind of, I mean, we worked for a long time together. I worked for a long time side to side with Dave Schaller. You know, of course, he started with the WEC and we used to cover that. And then he came up through the UFC. And I consider him a friend. I really do. It's funny because our wives met completely outside of us. They happened to meet each other on like Facebook through like social groups or whatever. It's like, oh, what does your husband do? That's weird. You know what my husband does? And then like they came in and said like, hey, you know who so and so is? Like, yeah, come on, that's like one of my that's a man I consider a friend. So it's kind of funny how that all worked in Las Vegas. But definitely consider a friend. So you know when somebody's a friend, you kind of bust their balls a little bit, right? You know, and he's doing good for himself, and you're like, oh, look at you, too good for us now, chilling in the Mandarin, you know? And, man, Dave was joking. He's like, dude, you don't even understand, like, how top-notch they do things in the NBA, you know? Private jets here and there. You know, you drop your bag off to the pilot at the hangar. Well, not the pilot, but, you know, the support staff at the hangar. And, you know, you don't see your bags again until you get to your room and your bag's already in your room. And, you know, you walk in the hotel and, you know, you don't walk up to the desk and go check in. No, you walk in and they're like, here you are, Mr. Morgan. Here, you're in room 1517 or whatever. You know, they just hand you your keys because they're waiting on you. So top notch, man. He's living it up. But, man, we sat down to just kind of relive some MMA, and it was fun, man. I think he had a blast doing it, and I had a blast catching up with him. And like I said, we're going to have some videos because we shot the whole thing, and we're going to add some B-roll in. You'll see when you hear it because we talked about different topics. Kind of like we did with Joe Carr, you know, we shot quite a bit, but then we broke up a little bit of it, like, per fight. But to hell with that, man. I thought you guys might enjoy just hearing the whole thing now, and then we'll break it up. It'll be on MMA Junk. It'll be on YouTube, and we'll break it up into pieces as it matters to some of the upcoming fights, which I think as you're listening to the conversation, you'll hear that. So, listen, without further delay, here is my conversation, catching up with Dave Schaller.
Dave, it's been about, I guess, 8 months with the Philadelphia 76ers. Tell us what life is like in the new job in the NBA.
Oh, it's been an adjustment, but it's been an adjustment that I've had so much fun with. You know, for me, when I made the decision to leave the UFC, it was the hardest decision I've ever made professionally. But ultimately, when I grew up in Atlantic City in the Arturo Thunder Gotti days and Kelly Pavlik and Bernard Hopkins and Tyson, I knew I wanted to work in the fight game. And if you would have told me when I started at the WEC at the end of 2008, 2009, started 2009, that I would have accomplished what I accomplished in the UFC and WEC, I would have told you were crazy. And for me, that was one dream. But another dream of mine has always been to win a championship in Philadelphia. And I'm a diehard Sixers fan. I interned there. It's where I cut my teeth in sports. I didn't want to be a what-if guy. So when I had the opportunity to, at 32, 33 years old, chase another dream, I didn't want to look back in 10 years. While I'm sure I would have been super happy at the UFC, I didn't want to look back and say, what if? It's been an incredible journey with the Sixers and a fantastic organization. The people remind me a lot of the people at the UFC, maniacal in their pursuit of success and excellence, a really tight-knit group of people. At times you go, man, we're just wired differently. And it reminds me a lot of the UFC. The first couple weeks I was at the Sixers, we had some injury issues, and I said, maybe it's me. But ultimately, it's been a really cool journey so far.
I know you're busy, and I mean, obviously, this is a top-level franchise, but do you still find time to watch fights? I mean, is MMA still part of your life?
Oh, no question. I'm a mega fight fan. You can't take that away from me. I didn't leave the UFC because I didn't like the fights. I still watch every fight. I've expanded my horizons a bit now that I have more free time. I watch Glory Kickboxing. I've been watching a lot of the different grappling stuff. I caught Chael's last fight, which was interesting because Chael and I are good buddies from way back. It's been cool to kind of sit back from a fan perspective. And it's been a little weird too. Saturday here for UFC 213, we had a game at the Thomas and Mack Center. And we're staying here at the Mandarin, which is a fantastic hotel. And to drive past the T-Mobile Arena, instinctually I was trying to make that right on Las Vegas Boulevard, but we kept going. And that was a weird feeling. What was not a weird feeling was reading the alert about the fight card change and going, I think I'm just gonna roll over and go back to the nap. That was kind of cool too.
Nice. What about in an NBA locker room, what's the awareness of MMA? I mean, do guys talk to you about the fight game?
Yeah, you know, a lot of our guys are between the ages of like 19 and 25, right in the sweet spot of UFC fandom. There's a lot of fans. The one cool thing that I realize, maybe now more than when I was in the bubble, if you will, is the adoration other athletes have for mixed martial artists, whether it's the toughness, we used to call it the switch, where, you know, once the cage door closes, that switch flips. I used to see that a lot with Cowboy Cerrone, you know, Cowboy being like a brother to me. We started our careers together. The cage door would close, and I was like, I don't know that guy anymore. Like, that guy in the cage, I don't know. Ronda Rousey was another prime example. When the cage door closed, or even when she did the walkout, quite frankly, I'm like, I don't know if I know her. But the adoration the other athletes have for mixed martial artists is, it's pure, it's true, and I still love talking fights. I was at a summer league game, and we were playing the San Antonio Spurs, and a guy walked up to me, and he goes, Dave Schaller? And listen, in the UFC world, our fans are so great in the UFC, like, it was cool to be recognized, but in the NBA, it doesn't happen, and no one confuses me with John Anik either, which is, John, I love you, a positive. But the guy came up to me, he's like, Dave Schaller? It's like, what's it like being in the NBA now that you're at the UFC? And we had this great conversation. And finally, he turns at me. He goes, you know what I have to ask you, right? And I'm like, hit me. He goes, what was it like being in between Jones and Cormier? The number one question I get from athletes, fans, grandmothers, everyone wants to know what that was like. So that was pretty cool.
That's cool. Let's talk about that. It's a great way to get into it. It was August 4th, 2014, almost 3 years ago, a date that'll live in infamy, the MGM brawl. I guess, let's start. You know, going into the press conference that day, what was the vibe like with those two guys? I mean, did you get a feeling like, guys, we got to be on high alert today?
I didn't have a feeling that it was going to become as volatile as it became. It didn't feel to me like any other press conference other than that I was super excited for the fight itself. I just knew that it was going to be electric. I knew that there was bad blood. But quite frankly, like when you talk about Chuck and Tito and Randy and some of those big fights, there's been bad blood in the UFC before. I mean, the UFC sells best when there's bad blood. So the atmosphere in the lobby was just energetic. There was something about the energy. And don't forget, Conor McGregor and Dustin Poirier were there too. So for me, it just felt like we were on the cusp of something special, which is funny because if you fast forward, we had to delay that fight. And Dana and I talked about this back in like October or November before I left. Had that fight taken place when it was supposed to take place in September, I'm not sure we're not sitting here talking about that being the biggest fight of all time, because it was headlines everywhere. And while you never want that type of incident to happen, it was just so volatile, so raw, so real. But the experience, to answer your question, in the MGM lobby that day, it didn't feel anything different than what I was used to, but there was something electric about the atmosphere. You had this young, up-and-coming star in Conor McGregor who just had it. You had John Jones who had so much, I guess you would call it, just this air of invincibility about him. And he is polarizing. And you had Daniel Cormier, this all-American guy, who for some reason was just rubbed the wrong way by John Jones. There was a side of Daniel Cormier that you saw that day. I said, that's not the same guy. This is wiring him differently. But if you had to ask me, you put me on the spot and said, who's throwing you off stage today? I would have said Connor and Dustin, not those two. And it was only because with John and with Daniel, they've both been at that level of dance before. They know how to sell the fight, but I didn't expect it to get physical like that.
So you bring them together for the face-off. I mean, we've seen it 100 times.
Before you go there, by the way, a lot of people ask me, like, do you have any regrets when your time in the UFC? You're damn right I do. And the biggest regret is not negotiating a royalty deal on that footage. I have literally seen myself thrown off the stage so many times. Like, if I got called a nickel, you might call me Dave Fertitta.
It is aired everywhere.
It's aired everywhere. I have a funny story. I'll let you ask your question. I have a funny story about an interaction with an NBA player, just to prove that point.
Well, I was going to say, so you bring them together for the face-off. They start out kind of traditional fashion. Yep. And they touch heads, basically, and Cormier shoves, and that's where, I mean, you don't know that John's going to throw a punch at that point, but immediately the panic sets in a little bit on you. Do you remember kind of what was going through your head?
So I remember two things. One, John beelining across the stage in a way that, you know, I had before that time done stare downs with Wanderlei Silva, all right? Like, I think I was equipped to know when guys are firing on a different cylinder. Although I didn't have as much experience as Dana being in the center of those things as much as he had. But the way John came across the stage, I'll never forget going, this doesn't feel right. And then Daniel does the two-handed throat slam. And I said, this is a little bit more than I bargained for today. And it all happened so quickly. I equate it, and I hope this doesn't sound too far-fetched, but it reminded me of a car accident that I had been in, where it happened so quickly, I don't necessarily remember the actions in the middle. The one thing I do remember is grabbing John Jones by the bicep, and for some reason thinking I was gonna stop him. Like, I know a lot of people make fun of the moment, but for some reason, like, I thought I was gonna stop the 6'4" brother of two NFL stars who happens to be the baddest man on the planet. But when I felt the strength of John Jones, I said, yeah, this isn't going to end too well for me. I made friends with the backdrop. And then John threw that left hand. And it was the equivalent of standing in the middle of a hurricane. The way the wind from that, I'll never forget that. That's what I remember, was that left hand, as I'm kind of falling backwards, just being winged at Daniel Cormier, as Daniel's falling backwards. And then the backdrop goes down, and, you know, it was chaos from there.
After everybody kind of gets broken up, John actually comes back on stage and starts yelling in front of the fans. And you're actually right in front of him. I went back and watched again. You were right there. At that point, because I can imagine, like you said, it's like a car crash happening so fast. At that point, is it starting to slow down a little bit, and you start going like, oh, shit, what just happened here?
There's no question. When it happened, it was so quick, but when John gets up and does the lion roar, which I call it, when he gets up on that side stage and does the lion roar, my instincts were, we've got to get these guys out of this area. And at that time, there was a couple guards on Daniel kind of dragging him out. There was a shoe that went flying by. But John a lot of people know John Jones from what they read or what they see. I know John Jones on a different level. I remember John coming into the UFC. I have had many car rides with John Jones. I have been to John Jones' house during some trying times in his professional career. I know John fairly well. And there's a level of respect that I have for John based on our relationship. The guy that was doing the lion roar was downright scary, because that was the guy that gets into the octagon when the door closes. That was the guy that was on another level. And on the flip side, just locking eyes with Daniel Cormier, the Olympian, the All-American dad, the Fox analyst, that wasn't that guy. That was a guy who felt like he had been wronged and disrespected. And I think that's the moment, if I could think about an epiphany, where I was like, we're really fortunate here that someone didn't get seriously injured. Forget me, or really anybody that was involved with trying to break it up. I'm talking about people checking into the hotel. You know, that day, if you remember, John, there were some older security guards working the event for the mere purpose of crowd control. So I think when it started to calm down after he did the lion roar, I said, we've got to get this thing under control. But I was looking around and just kind of assessing the carnage.
Kind of a tough balance, right? Because as you said, it made it the biggest fight ever. I think it still may be. I mean, obviously, yeah. All that stuff's getting brought back up. And
right. Yeah, I mean, listen, I wrestle with that moment from a professional standpoint, in the sense that the fight game is not rainbows and butterflies. It's not. The biggest fights in UFC history, the biggest fights in boxing history, are rooted in bad blood. Now listen, we're incredibly fortunate that no one was truly injured in that altercation. But I think it also demonstrated the level of animosity in a way that no promo could. I had a chance to see the new promo that Craig Borsari and Dana had cut, that aired over the weekend at 2:13. And to me, it brought me back to the moment, because it captured the story so well, but it also captured the animosity. This is not fake. This is not something that's been manufactured. These guys want to beat the hell out of each other. So when you talk about Anaheim, California at the end of July, if that's not circled on your date, with all due respect to Connor and Floyd and the hype that fight's going to create, there's a dance a month before that's maybe just as important, if not more important, to the overall history of mixed martial arts.
Well said. You talked about John Jones and having a relationship with him. I mean, I've seen him come up as well. I wonder what your thought is just on him and the future that he's got in front of him, because you know, you saw the promo. I mean, it's a great recap of everything that he's gone through, and it sounds like he's saying, you know, I'm finally in a place where I'm ready to move past that. Do you think John can keep his nose clean, so to speak? Yeah, well, maybe not.
We'll cut that one. Let me reset on that one.
Can stay out of trouble.
John Jones has had his fair share of adversity, a lot of it self-inflicted. I know John on a level where I think deep down there's a better human being that he's put forward in the public eye. I've seen him interact with his kids. I've seen him interact with his late mother. I've seen how he interacts with his brothers. I think, and this is not in defense of John Jones, because it's not my place, but John had achieved such a level of incredible success at the age of 23. The money, the fame, the notoriety, the distractions, walking into a club and having people throw whatever you want at that particular star. I think it shows you the real responsibility that comes with fame and money and celebrity. And I think he'd tell you firsthand that he didn't balance it well early in his career. I think what has happened to John, whether it was the legal incidents or the lawsuit or just being out of action, I think it's humanized him in a sense that he realizes that none of this is a given. None of this is something you can take for granted. And a John Jones with a professional chip on his shoulder is a scary John Jones.
No doubt. You mentioned you had a story on from an NBA player or an NBA.
Yeah. So we had an incredible 2017 NBA draft, and you know, our president of basketball operations, Brian Colangelo, is a real masterful negotiator. And talent evaluator. So we execute a trade with the Orlando Magic for the 25th overall pick, and we pick a teammate of Kristaps Porzingis, center by the name of Andrzej Pachecznik from Latvia. So we fly him in for the, or excuse me, we train him up from New York, and the next day we're trying to do the introductory press conference in Camden, New Jersey, where our headquarters is. And Andrzej's manager is staring at me intently. And it wasn't the stare of like, hey, what's that guy doing? It was the stare of, I know you, and I'm not sure why you're here. So he grabs one of our vice presidents in the basketball operations department. He goes, what's the UFC guy doing here? Why is the UFC guy here? And, you know, we explained to him that I had come back and I'm with the Sixers now. I had interned here in 2004. And he goes, no, it's the UFC guy. And he has this thick Latvian accent. But it was just kind of cool because it reminded me, we got into the Jones-Cormier story, and the UFC, and John, you know this from your travels around the globe. No one is more traveled in the UFC or in the sport than you. You realize the global nature of this sport. Whether it was in Brazil when I traveled there, I ran into fans when I was in Mexico, and they look at the people behind the scenes of the UFC almost like they look at the fighters, which has always been something that's hard for me to wrap my head around. I appreciate every high five and handshake, and I appreciate everybody going out of their way to tweet me. Even to this day, people still tweet me asking me why we're not making certain fights. And I'm like, listen, I'll give you an example today. And let me generalize this for you. I'll give you an example. Gegard Mousasi, he makes an announcement that he's going to Bellator. Within 1 hour of that announcement, I get a tweet from a fan going, how come you didn't pay Gegard more money? I should have responded, does he play power forward? But it just shows you the UFC stays with you in the best way possible. And sometimes there are moments in your life, whether it's the Jones-Cormier altercation or me bear hugging Connor when they're throwing Monster Energy cans at each other. There are moments that you look back on and you say, damn, what a wild ride.
You know, you mentioned Connor there. It's crazy because, you know, the incident there with Nate Diaz, the fact that he was there the day that this Jones-Cormier stuff started. I'm just curious, given that, do you remember meeting Connor for the first time? Do you remember when he first popped up on your radar?
I do.
And give me your first impression of him.
I met him in Boston, Massachusetts when he fought Max Holloway. And I remember we were at the, I think it was the Wang Theater. I have to do the fact check there. But I remember meeting him at the Wang Theater in Boston, and he walked kind of behind the curtain, and he has that big, like, Vince McMahon swagger walk that he has, and he walks that way every day. Like, he walks into the convenience store that way, he walks into Target that way. That's how Connor walks. And I remember saying, man, this guy's got some confidence. And he walked and he talked with such a swagger and a confidence that I remember it just stuck with me. Connor McGregor, to me, is the one human being in my lifetime that I've met that believes everything that comes out of his mouth. And I don't mean that negatively. He talks a lot about visualization. And I think it's a powerful tool, to be quite honest. A lot of us in our lives are trying to get to certain points, and I think getting there is a lot easier when you can visualize it, touch it, taste it, feel it. Connor believes and wills things into existence. There's been times where I'm like, there's no way Connor's beating this guy. There's no way Connor can outstrike Jose Aldo or survive the wrestling of Chad Mendez or not get pinned up against the fence by Eddie Alvarez. That's not a knock on those guys and the fact that they were defeated. It's just they're so highly proficient in those skills. And you look at Connor like, how's he going to solve this puzzle? He says it. He does it. And we laugh. He calls himself Mystic Mac. But damn, he knows what he's talking about. So for me, that first interaction in Boston, I was remarkably overwhelmed by his confidence in the best way possible. It wasn't like this brash arrogance. It was, this guy knows what he wants from life, and he's going to do everything he can to get it. And if you had to ask me right now, aside from this big boxing match, which Conor McGregor fight could potentially fire me up the most, give me Max Holloway. If you watch that fight from Boston, it was vintage of both of them in terms of toughness. Connor blows out his ACL in the first round. You know, Max gets wheeled out that night because of the damage that he took. and you think about their evolution as fighters. I'd love to see the Nate rematch, and I'd love to see a lot of other fights, but when this is all said and done with Mayweather, give me Max Holloway and Conor McGregor. Give me that fight, because that's the fight, like Justin Gaethje and Michael Johnson, where you buy a ticket, sit down, have a beer, and relax. That's going to be a hell of a fight.
You mentioned the Mayweather thing. I mean, you were around when the rumors first started coming out, right?
Yeah.
The reports came around. And you touched on it perfectly, like the visualization and like willing things into existence. I mean, when that first started coming up, obviously you're very tied into operations at the time. I mean, were you even thinking like, there's no way in hell this is going
to
happen?
I had kind of rolled my eyes a bit, to be honest, at the concept of it for a couple of reasons. You know, obviously the fact that they are two very distinctly different sports that are regulated by the same bodies but differently. Typically, you don't get a 49-0 fighter against an 0-0 fighter. And certainly, the contractual boundaries that were with the Showtime deal with Mayweather and the fact that, you know, Conor's exclusive to the UFC. I don't want to say I said never, because I learned very quickly in my WEC career, never say never. But I didn't know if it could get across the line. And then I shared an exchange on direct message with Conor after he so eloquently and so Conor got in the faces of the boxing media at Madison Square Garden. I think he was there for one of his teammates, one of his fellow Irishmen. And I read the direct message in his voice, and he said, "I'm going to knock him the fuck out." And I said, "This guy, he's doing it again. He's willing this thing into existence, and I'll be damned, he gets Dana on board, he gets Showtime on board, he gets Floyd on board. He's a special character. He is challenging. He's never on time. But Dana said something that's spot on. Conor's a fighter. You need a guy to fight 25 minutes from now, Conor's there. You need a guy to headline a fight card, Conor's there. You need a guy to be the cornerstone of your organization, Conor's there. He's going to get there on his own time. That may be an hour late, that may be 2 hours late, maybe right on time when he surprises you. But Conor shows up in big game situations. And for me, that puts him in the same air as some of the greatest athletes of our time.
Knowing that you don't have to promote this fight, give us your thoughts on it. I mean, you hear the range of spectrums. There's, you know, Max Kellerman's out there saying he won't even land a punch, you know, and then other people are saying, I think he wins the fight. I mean, is this a competitive fight? Are you excited about it? Is it just a freak show? What do you think about it?
You know, my first reaction is to all the purists of boxing and the purists of MMA and all the, you know, kind of Skip Bayless debates, and I get it, but stop for a second, all right? Stop with the freak show stuff. Stop with the why is this happening. Stop. Listen, combat sports, in my eyes, first and foremost, aside from being an incredible sport, is an incredibly pure form of entertainment. So when you talk about this fight in this time in our society where people are arguing about some really serious things, whether it be political, whether it be with our president, whatever it may be, sit back and enjoy the fact that we have two of the greatest fighters from their respective sports getting in the same ring. You have someone with the brass balls of Conor McGregor that goes, you know what? I will risk it all to try myself in another sport and fight the greatest of all time. I get it for the purists. I understand that you want to see Gennady Golovkin or Canelo Alvarez. I get it. But for August 26th, just sit back. Enjoy the spectacle that is this combat sports life. So for me, you know, people have asked me what are my thoughts on the fight. Conor is leaving the comfort zone of his sport that he's so proficient in and going into a completely different realm. You know, I was fortunate to start my career in boxing. They are two very distinctly different sports. But the great equalizer is that left hand. If he lands it one time, 20 times, whatever it may be, it has the chance to change the course of Floyd Mayweather's history. And I know that sounds like the UFC promoter speak coming out of me. It is the truth. On the flip side, Floyd Mayweather is one of the most brilliant defensive tacticians in the history of the game. With the shoulder roll and the high guard defense and the ability for him to just pick opponents apart, can Conor sustain the typical pace he has over 12 rounds while trying to, you know, at times chase Floyd, at times, you know, get his punches off. I don't know, but I'll tell you what, August 26th, you know, I got my guy Mauro Ranallo on the call. I'm watching because you know what? I'm at the point in my life now where I sit back and I just enjoy it for what it is, which is one hell of a spectacle and what I hope is one hell of a moment that we remember forever. It's probably going to go one of two ways, John. Floyd's going to become the next victim of the left hand, or he's going to do what he's done his entire career, which is find a way to cruise the 12th. Either way, it's getting my $99.
I hear that. You know, Connor's one in a million, man. You had 500, 600 guys on the roster at Tom. I wonder, is there advice you could give to somebody? I mean, part of your job was helping build stars. So there's all these athletes out there that I think are trying to get themselves recognized, get themselves known, find out how they go to the next level. If you were advising a young up-and-come fighter, what would you tell them to how they can help build their star?
One, you know, I subscribe to this theory in my life, and it's a big reason why I made the move to the Sixers. I think you have to be really comfortable being uncomfortable and putting yourself in situations to get outside of what you are used to doing or what you expect yourself to do. I think one of the small downsides of the McGregor era is everyone now feels like they have to talk like Conor, they have to carry themselves like Conor, they have to fight in different events like Conor. It's not that. What Conor has done so successfully is he's demonstrated the power of embracing who he really is. Conor would show up to a recreational tennis match in a fur coat and a red shirt. Conor, that's Conor. It doesn't turn off and on. I've seen him. Conor believes his own hype, and rightfully so, because he's gone out and proven it. So what I would tell to young fighters is be genuine, be who you want to be, but ultimately, this sport of mixed martial arts is a 110% sport. You can't be half in, you can't be half out. I think the UFC space is so fortunate to have really dedicated media members across digital, across TV, across radio. Embrace that. Have a professional, courteous relationship with the media. Understand that in the era of 500 plus athletes, you do have to stand out differently. Some of it may be like Cowboy Cerrone and just being who you are naturally. Some of it may be the quiet confidence of a Joanna Jędrzejczyk, who also has that chip on her shoulder. You know, for me, another fighter that I think has a chance to have an incredible upside in this sport is Cody Garbrandt. Is Cody the best trash talker I've ever seen? No, he's not. He doesn't have to be. He's got an incredible look. He fights his ass off. And when push comes to shove, he shows up. And he demonstrates that he's one of the best in the world. I also think for young fighters, a piece of advice that I would give is try to put yourself in a situation where you have a mentor. It's what I love what Uriah Faber's doing in Sacramento, creating an atmosphere and a culture for success, what Mike Brown is doing down at ATT, what Frankie Edgar's doing in New Jersey, what Chris Weidman and Ray Longo are doing, and what Greg Jackson and his team do. See what success looks like, and then make your own interpretation of what you want it to be like for you. But I think it's really important, and it was cool for me in my UFC career. There'd be times, especially young, when I was in my mid-20s, Dana would pull me in the meetings, and I'd be like, what the hell am I doing in this meeting? I am way over my head. I'm grappling Hoyce Gracie here. Like, this is way over. He was challenging me. He was trying to see if I had that next level gear, and I hope I demonstrated that to him. But sometimes I think if you're a young fighter like a Landon Venata, or if you're, you know, a young up-and-coming woman star down at ATT, whatever it may be, if you get in a situation where you can look and say, all right, that's what success looks like, it allows you to chart your own course.
Nice. You talked about Uriah Faber. I want to ask you, because, I mean, you're in the NBA now. You were high, you know, you had the love in the UFC as well. You were high-ranking there, but I got to think the WC is always going to hold a place in your heart. I mean, he just made it into the UFC Hall of Fame this past week for basically what he did in the WC is what got him there. But where were your time in the WC ranked to you, and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, the WEC, for me, it feels like a family member. It really does. It feels like a bond that it's hard for me to explain except to people like Reed Harris and Pete Dropick and Sean Shelby and Melissa Henricks and, you know, Antonio Banuelos and Uriah Faber and Miguel Torres. Like, You had to live it and breathe it. You had to be guys like John Morgan. You had to be, you know, guys that, like Matt Erickson. I'll never forget Matt Erickson comes to our Jeff Curran fight, and Miguel Torres is on the card in Chicago. And it just felt different. The WEC experience for me was where I made a lot of mistakes. It's where I had a lot of success. But ultimately, every time I looked over my shoulder, someone had my back, whether it was a fighter, whether it was a fellow executive. It was the closest I've ever been professionally to us against the world. We weren't the name value of the UFC. We didn't have some of the sex appeal of Strikeforce, and we didn't have that cult-like following at the time that Pride had. But I'll never forget my very first live WEC card when Miguel Torres fought Takeo Mizugaki. And if you remember that fight over five rounds, I'm getting, as Dana always says, I'm getting chills. I feel like I'm Dana. I'm getting chills thinking about it. It was one of those fights where I said, I moved to Las Vegas with about $80 in my bank account. And I'd move all over again for that opportunity for the WEC. It was something I'm so proud of having been a part of. And when people tweet me or send me photos from WEC, I still light up. It gives me great pleasure to see guys like Eddie Wineland still competing at this level. I just came back to Las Vegas, and I was at the Performance Institute, which is a fantastic facility. And I walk into the training room, and Joseph Benavidez is there. And Joseph's coming back from a pretty significant knee injury, and he hops up off the table on one leg, and he gives me a hug. It was a brother hug. And I don't mean to like sound warm. We went through something in the WEC coming up together that it's like a family. I hope one day there's a 30 for 30 on WEC, because the stories that guys like Reed Harris and I could tell, the stories of him getting a rental car stuck in the mud in Chicago and telling me at 24 years old to get out and push as mud is like spraying all over. The stories of, you know, Donald Cerrone, Leonard Garcia, Reed Harris and I going to Youngstown, Ohio for what should have been Ben Henderson versus Cowboy Cerrone 1. And I'll never forget, we get there at 1 in the morning and we didn't eat very well back then, neither did Cowboy, so we go to McDonald's and we get whatever we could get at 1 a.m. And we go back to start the press tour 4 hours later, and the drive-thru attendant goes, "You guys again? Nobody comes to this McDonald's this much." And we were in Youngstown, and I remember our very first hit was on an NBC affiliate in Youngstown. And we get to the door, and they like there was something wrong with the schedule. They thought we were coming 2 days later or whatever. So they slot us on, and Reed Harris is in this really nice, you know, black button-up shirt with black jeans and dress shoes. And he goes on after the Adopt-a-Dog segment. And there is this big yellow lab that rubs up against Reed as he's going on to the set. And he just does this interview in like this black outfit with dog hair all over him. That, to me, was the WEC. We were up at 4 or 5 a.m. doing these NBC affiliates. If it sold one ticket, we'd do it. If it got one ounce of recognition, we'd do it. I'll never forget San Antonio, Texas, the eventual spot of Cowboy and Benson Henderson 1, still to this day my favorite fight. The San Antonio Spurs, who we played in Summer League a couple of days ago, which was, it always brings me back to this moment. They were playing a summer exhibition game for their fans. It was free, and we were playing the same arena, and Reed and I flyered the parking lot together of the AT&T Center. So Pete Dropick, who at the time was the VP of WEC, gets a call from the GM of the AT&T Center and says, "Hey, did you flyer the AT&T Center?" So he calls us, and Reed's like, "Yeah, I'm not sure who did it. Not sure who did it." Another fun story, we did the Palms. I think it was a Scotty Jorgensen fight, Dominic Cruz. They fought in Phoenix. They were both on the card, I believe, whatever it was. We did a WEC fight at the Palms. So at the time, and he still does, Lorenzo Fertitta owns Station Casinos. So Reed and his son Pat, who I love, they flyer the Palace Station parking lot to try to get ticket sales and awareness. And Lorenzo calls Reed and he's like, "Reed, did you assign a staff member to flyer the Palace parking lot?" And Reed's like, yeah, I signed myself and my son. So security's chasing Reed and his son through the Palace Station parking lot as they're firing cars on their way out. That was WEC.
That is awesome, man. That is awesome. It's funny because I do feel like, you know, it ended, you said it didn't at the time have that cult following. Like, I think people do have that love. You know, the WEC never forget. It kind of like Pride Never Die or whatever. But, you know, you guys had the added thing of marketing little guys, right? Yeah. And that seems to be a struggle now. What do you feel like? Do you feel like why is it hard to sell the little guys? I mean, Demetrius Johnson's got to be one of the most exciting mixed martial artists, you know, to ever grace the planet.
I'll go one step further. I think he is the pound-for-pound best fighter to ever do it. With all due respect to Fedor and John Jones and Anderson Silva, I think Demetrius Johnson is the pound-for-pound best fighter I've ever seen compete. And he showed me a lot of resolve. You know, if you remember, he fought Brad Pickett in the WEC, and that was kind of a turning point moment for him. He loses the fight. It was on short notice. He got kind of ragdolled a bit in that fight, and you wonder how a guy was going to come back. And not only did he come back, he went on one of the greatest runs in UFC and WEC history. To me, it's a struggle in the sense that sometimes when you have greatness, you can lose a little perception of reality. And I think we forget, with all due respect to the Spider, Anderson Silva, he wasn't a major draw until Chael Sonnen came along. I'm not sure DJ needs a Chael Sonnen, but I think the UFC is doing an ample job of trying to promote him in the sense that he had the Ultimate Fighter show. He's been co-main eventing major cards. For Demetrius Johnson, I equate it a bit to Floyd Mayweather's early career. When you think back to Floyd Mayweather when he was Pretty Boy Floyd, when he was fighting Carlos Baldomir and Arturo Gatti, he was doing good numbers, but he was not Money Mayweather. Sometimes these weight classes take time, and some of the fruits of the labor may not be there for Demetrius in terms of recognition by the time he's ready to retire. But I think we'll be sitting here in 50 years talking about Demetrius Johnson like baseball players talk about Babe Ruth, like basketball players talk about Jordan, like hockey players talk about Gretzky. He's that damn good. But sometimes the publicity and the hype doesn't catch you when it's supposed to. So I don't necessarily think DJ's doing anything wrong because he's true to himself. And I don't think the UFC's doing anything wrong. It's just a matter of trying to find that spark, that perfect moment. Sometimes it's Jones and Cormier fighting on the stage. Sometimes it's Ronda Rousey armbarring the hell out of everyone they put in her way. And sometimes it's a 5'9" Irishman who talks the talk and walks the walk. It's not one size fits all. And if there was one thing I learned in the star building aspect of the UFC, one, it is not one size fits all. And if I can add a second, it's sometimes it happens when you expect it, and sometimes it happens when you don't. A lot of people know Justin Gaethje now. With all due respect to his career in the World Series of Fighting, a lot of people know who he is now. Gilbert Melendez is one of the most accomplished fighters in the history of the 155-pound division. The night he fought not only Josh Thompson, but the night he fought Diego Sanchez, a lot of people woke up the next morning and watched SportsCenter and go, I got to know who Gilbert Melendez is a little bit more. Sometimes it doesn't happen when you plan it or when you want it, but when it happens, you know it.
Well, you're doing well for yourself in the NBA, but anything you missed from the MMA game?
You know, it's funny. I get the question a lot. Do you miss the MMA game? Do you miss UFC? What do you miss? I miss the people. And the UFC is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week business, and it's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job. For members of the media, for the fighters, for the staff, it is a grind. There's a lot of flights, there's a lot of connections, there's a lot of hotels, there's a lot of rental cars, and there's a lot of your fair share of a 2 a.m., where am I going to eat? It's a tough lifestyle. I equate it to what the WWE professional wrestlers go through in terms of some of the grind and the rigors of that lifestyle. I miss the people the most. I miss the fighters. I miss the staff members. But I miss them in a way that I'm very content that the chapter is closed, but I miss them like I miss friends from high school or from college. Because you think about all the good times, you laugh now at some of the bad times. You know, the UFC has always had an interesting relationship with the media. That's well documented, and I lived it for a long time. But I'll tell you this, I was very fortunate in the UFC to create relationships with members of the media that will extend for many, many years. And whether the media want to admit it now or the UFC wants to admit it now, we were all, to a certain extent, in it together. Because I remember when MMA Junkie was scratching and clawing with Dan Stupp and John Morgan and just clinging to hope that this sport took off. And all of a sudden, the rewards started racking up. You know, Ariel Helwani, he's had a well-documented history with the UFC and the PR side, but I remember when he was working for Jari Park and Versus and grinding along the way. There's so many reporters, you know, guys that you have on your site that have risen with the UFC. That's kind of cool.
Six is going to do this year?
We're excited. You know, we're so fortunate to have this dynamic young nucleus that we have with Joel Embiid, Dario Saric, Ben Simmons, Markel Fultz, Rob Covington. We just added J.J. Redick and Amir Johnson. We feel like we're on the cusp of something special. It's going to take some time to materialize and gel and bond, but I say this not for the sexy headline. I say this because I believe it in my soul. What's going on in Philadelphia right now reminds me of when I started with the UFC. It feels like the airplane is getting ready to take off, and somehow a trailer park kid from South Jersey has a seat on the plane. And every time I go to an arena, and I did this in the WEC, and I do it every time I'm in the NBA, I walk around the arena, and I've never shared this. I don't know why I feel compelled to share it today. I walk around the arena when it's completely empty. If that means I have to get there 2 hours early, whatever. Occasionally there's an usher or somebody sweeping up the concourse, and I just grab a seat and I sit and I just look around and I just soak it all in. Perspective, I think, is one of the greatest things you can have in life. So I sit in those arenas and I just look around and I say, damn, it is really cool to be a part of this thing, to be able to look back in my professional yearbook and say I did 8 years with the fastest growing sport. It sold for $4 billion from Chuck to Connor to Ronda to Minotauro, just the legends that I was able to work with, to now being able to work with the Embiids and the Simmons and the Sariches and the Fultzes. I don't know how it's all worked out, and I don't know if there's a God, a Buddha, I don't know anything about that, but every night I say thanks to someone. I've been really, really blessed, and I'm not sure if my days in the fight game are over forever, but I'll tell you one thing. I can't wait to embark on this journey of trying to win a championship in Philadelphia. It's what fires me up, but I wouldn't be too surprised one day, whether it's on the smaller scale or whether it's with a big promotion or whatever it may be, if I fulfill the journey I feel like I can fulfill in the NBA, if I don't have a chair octagon side again one day.
Welcome back to the MMA Roadshow. That was Dave Schaller, former UFC VP, now doing big things with the Philadelphia 76ers. Hopefully you guys liked that. I enjoyed it, man. It was fun catching up. And what it made me think, especially like the fun WC stories, because I wanted, I had these things I wanted to talk about, and I didn't know how comfortable we'd be talking about everything, but I think he got more and more comfortable, and I got more and more comfortable, and so we're going to do that again, man. Next time he's in Vegas for whatever reason, or maybe we'll fly out and see him, and just, you know, when we're doing an East Coast show or something like that, we'll make the drive. We'll find a way. I want to get together with him. What I really want to do, though, I was thinking, because, he was a big part of the UFC, but, man, he was a huge part of the WC. I think you heard the stories. I mean, it was, like, grassroots stuff. I think it would be awesome to maybe get, like, me, Dave Schaller, Reed Harris, maybe some fighters even that were in the WC. I don't know. I mean, Danny Castillo's a guy that I've always loved, man. I met him before he was even in the WC, just, you know, drinking cold beers out at Tachi Palace, you know, watching fights. So I always liked that guy. Maybe he might be somebody we could have in, but who knows, man. I would love to hear some old stories, and we touched on that a little bit, and I don't know. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. I had fun talking about it, and I think we're going to have some cool videos, talking about, obviously, Connor, but talking about the Jones and Cormier stuff. We'll kind of edit that down a little bit, throw some B-roll in it. I think it'll be a little fun. So, anyway, listen, Cole Coffee, believe it or not, is still not back to his hotel from this presser. I mean, they got all kinds of stuff going on. The man, send him some love. Send him some love, because I guarantee you, He probably wants to kill me for sending him out there to these trips, to be honest with you. And, you know, he gets a little cranky from time to time. I know he's on very little sleep, and it has been every bit the shit show that Dana White said it would be. So hopefully you guys enjoyed the coverage. I think we're going to have several more weeks of it. Hopefully they get it together for London. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. We'll be watching that fight, covering that fight one or the other, but I'm bummed. Now I've had a little time to think more. I'm still just as disappointed. This is the first day where I'm just like, I'm over it. I'm over it. I kind of need some time away. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. I think it's pretty common knowledge, but if you didn't know, it's my understanding that Connor's going to do the rest of his training camp in Las Vegas. So he's going to finish up. He's not flying back over. I guess they're going over for London, but that's why I thought they were going to start in the other direction. I think he's, from what I've been told, he's going to do the rest of his camp in Vegas. So, I don't know, maybe we could sneak over there and get a few minutes with him. I know he's a busy guy, not necessarily the easiest interview to get in the sport, but maybe we could do it. We'll see what happens. All right, listen, so weekend, I'll be at Bellator 181. The European crew, you know all them, they'll be at the Scotland event, Glasgow, covering that one. Hopefully you enjoyed everything that Cold Coffee did. MMA junkies everywhere, we got you everywhere. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it all, and hopefully you guys enjoyed the conversation with Dave Schaller. I promise we will have Cold Coffee back in the building next week, talking the madness that was the three stops of Mayweather-McGregor, and maybe we'll even get a little bit of Abby Subban. Check in with him, and he can tell us how this London thing is. Hopefully he has better luck than we did. In the meantime, thank you very, very much for listening.